Hello and welcome to the Currency Exchange, NowWest Markets FX podcast, where we help to break down the major themes and events driving markets this week and in the weeks ahead. Today, I'm joined by Brian Dangerfield, who is our US head of G10 FX strategy, and we will discuss some recent events that happened last weekend. On Saturday the 13th and Sunday the 14th of April, Iran launched an unprecedented attack against Israel, launching drones and missiles into the territory. The two adversaries have been engaged in a shadow war for years, but this was the first time that they had such a direct conflict. Also, in the earlier hours of Saturday, Iran's Revolutionary Guard seized an Israeli-affiliated container ship in the Strait of Hormuz. Brian, let me turn to you now. You know, obviously, we've had very unprecedented events, a real escalation in terms of this conflict. What did financial markets make of it?
Thank you very much for having me, Eimear. So, you know, it's important to consider the market reaction to these escalations as happening within the broader context of rising market volatility. You know, as we know from the more fundamental and economic perspective, one of the big developments over the last week and a half has been this US CPI coming in much stronger than expected, leading to, among other things, expectations of higher rates for longer, the potential for more entrenched inflation in the US and what that means for other regions and central banks and what that means for other currencies. And additionally, higher market volatility, this prospect of higher rates in the US for longer, the possibility, what that means for growth over the more medium term. Generally speaking, we've had a pickup in market volatility. And these, you know, this escalation only adds to that sense of greater market volatility. Now, certainly, you know, the situation remains fluid, to say the least. But over the last week and a half, there have been a number of developments which have sort of pushed in the direction of higher market volatility coming from a number of sources. And this is certainly one of those. And the FX reaction, I think, has been pretty consistently towards a stronger dollar as sort of a representation of not only a currency where growth and inflation continue to be quite strong, but also because of its safe haven status and its relatively high interest rate compared to many of its developed market peers, the dollar has done well in an environment where global volatility is seen as rising. And so the dollar has strengthened against a number of currencies. Oil has, you know, it's been volatile over the last couple of sessions here as the market has tried to figure out where exactly the long term, what the long term implications of this escalation may or may not be. But you have seen oil prices have been moving higher in periods, not just from the developments over the last week or week and a half, but generally over the course of 2024, oil prices have been increasing. And so I think one of the big takeaways from the events that we've had so far is that within the broader context, global volatility, whether you look at rates markets or FX markets, has started to show some signs of picking up after a very, very low start to the year. Global volatility, asset market volatility was falling for most of 2024 heading into the last 2 weeks. Now you've had a couple of developments which have started to push that in the opposite direction. And that's generally bad news for the world's carry currency, cyclically and growth linked currencies, and generally better news for some of the low yielders and the safe havens, including the dollar. So Eimear, I want to turn it back to you and talk about, where do you think we go from here? This was obviously a big source of escalation from the Iranian side in terms of a direct strike on Israel. As we record this, we don't know exactly how Israel's response and the Western response more broadly is going to play out. What do you think the case is for regional escalation? Do you think we might be heading towards a broader escalation, or do you think that the steady state of high tension but no broader regional conflict is more likely here?
Yeah, as you say, you know, developments are still playing out, so it's still very much in flux. But our base case is that, you know, the emphasis is on containment rather than escalation. And I think in those few hours, you know, since the event happened, I thought there was kind of three key things which really kind of reinforced that there would be more a diplomatic reaction to the events as opposed to kind of increasing and obviously widening that conflict. So I thought what was interesting was that, you know, Iran's strike was symbolic rather than consequential. It was always kind of engineered so that, you know, it wouldn't have kind of big fatalities. And, you know, Iran gave 12 days of warning, and he consistently warned in the lead up that it would strike Iran. And obviously there were no fatalities from the event. The overwhelming majority of the drones and missiles were intercepted. You know, another kind of interesting dynamic was just how much kind of it was an international response. And Iran kind of came out and acknowledged and gave a lot of credit to its allies in really kind of intercepting and helping Israel defend itself within that attack. And really, even what we've seen afterwards is, you know, that G7 meeting on Sunday, you know, we are kind of emphasizing a kind of united allied response to Iran's attack, as opposed to just kind of Israel going it alone. The third thing I would point to was that in the immediate aftermath, you know, Netanyahu called a meeting of his war cabinet, but it only included 5 members. And interestingly, it did not include the more extremist far-right members of his coalition, which would push for retaliation and direct strike against Iran. And that tells us, you know, he's not going to be kind of influenced or driven by those factions within his internal party, but more actually by his broader allies. And I think, you know, it is worth kind of noting just the big cost of this war for Israel. Obviously, you know, they've got ongoing military confrontations within Gaza, but now also starting a conflict on another front does entail more cost, and it's extremely reliant on its allies in order to fund that. So the emphasis that the US has given on having kind of a sanctions response as opposed to a military response should be guiding in that respect. But, you know, Brian, I wanted to kind of pull you in on what we've seen in terms of response, particularly from the US so far.
Yeah, so as we record on Thursday, the Biden administration has announced additional sanctions on Iran in the form of sanctions against Iranian individuals and on the Iranian military complex. It's important that the sanctions have stayed so far away from Iranian oil industry, right? So, you know, certainly ever since the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA, the Iran deal in 2018, the U.S. has had and maintained sanctions on Iran's oil industry, including secondary sanctions, which are sanctions on buyers of Iranian oil. So far, we haven't seen any additional sanctions specifically targeted at Iranian oil industry. But one of the things that we've been monitoring, and certainly the market has sort of caught wind of, is that Iranian oil production and exports have appeared to have been rising over the past, you know, call it 6 to 9 months. And a lot of those exports are likely heading towards China, specifically China and perhaps other parts of Asia as well. You think of India, similar with the buyers of Russian oil, as you know, under sanction from the U.S., sort of the same potential buyers of Iranian oil. Members of Congress, especially from the Republican Party, have accused the U.S. of perhaps being a bit lax in its sanctions enforcement on Iran, that there isn't a JCPOA deal in place, but that perhaps the U.S. and Iran have reached a bit of a behind-the-scenes agreement that Iran would not be pursuing nuclear weapons or not be moving forward with this kind of regional escalation. And in exchange, the U.S. would not be hard enforcing some of these secondary sanctions, especially in allowing some drift higher in Iranian oil production. That's to certainly receive some criticism within the U.S. Those criticisms are only going to get significantly louder from here. So you certainly can't rule out new sanctions, or at very least a bigger push from the opposition party in particular to try and really enforce those sanctions greater. And so I think there's still a possibility that you see lost barrels from Iran as a consequence of the escalation that we've seen from the weekend. But even so, I think the Russia example is one that really speaks true to where we might be going as far as Iranian oil. Because if the largest buyer of Iranian oil by a long margin is China, which is our expectation, I believe the global consensus as well, China is not particularly, you know, I don't think China is particularly worried about what U.S. sanctions policy says in terms of its own pursuing its own agenda and its own alliances, and in terms of buying cheap and likely below market priced oil from countries that don't really have a lot of other alternatives. You've seen buying of Russian oil and likely buying of Iranian oil could continue. And so from a lost barrels perspective, I think that's important to consider, that if the U.S. and Western allies are moving forward or try and enhance restrictions on Iranian oil, that might not have a big impact because I think most of that's going to China, and China's willingness to buy and import Iranian oil might not be as influenced by Western sanctions as much as, say, most other global nations. I did want to ask you about another potential source of escalation, thinking about oil supplies, and that's the Strait of Hormuz, which is, you know, the critical oil strait between Oman and Iran, and, you know, a lot of global oil and a lot of global energy trade moves through there. Iran has borders there. There's the possibility that they could use military to try and blockade or block that critical export. Do you think there's prospects that Iran can try and move in the direction of trying to block the Strait of Hormuz? And how do you think that might factor into the possibility of greater escalation?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This is kind of the worst case scenario. And I think the IEA has come out and, you know, said this is the world's, you know, most critical oil transit route. And we're not just talking about Iranian oil. We're talking about 21% of global consumption, 25% of LNG consumption. And the key thing is there is no alternative route. So unlike the Houthi attacks we had previously around the Red Sea, where, you know, boats could take a two-week detour at a much higher cost, they had that alternative that is not kind of a luxury that shippers would have in this situation. I think it is definitely feasible that Iran could block this strait. And I think we saw that in Saturday's events, that it wasn't just the missile and drone strike. They did, you know, take hostage an Israeli-affiliated container ship on the Strait of Hormuz. And that was a very clear signal that they would, you know, they could deliver on that threat to block that strait. And I think also, you know, what we have seen in the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea is that, you know, allied kind of defense mechanism was ultimately unsuccessful, right? The operation that the US initiated couldn't deter those Houthi militants, and container vessels actually had to take that long detour. So it would be, you know, as you say, you stopping a massive component of global oil supply from reaching the market. And, you know, if there is no alternative maritime routes, but there isn't enough spare capacity in pipelines either. There is only two major pipelines that service that area. And in terms of unused capacity, it would just be overwhelmed by the 21 million barrels per day that transit through that key waterway. So certainly, you know, I thought it was interesting that in the aftermath of the weekend's events, actually we saw oil prices trading lower because almost it was kind of relief from the market that they hadn't gone kind of the worst case scenario at the lower end of expectations. But I guess on that kind of our kind of extreme tail risk for oil prices, putting that to one side, Brian, what is your kind of longer term view on the basis that we don't have a regional escalation?
Yeah, I mentioned at the outset that the oil prices have been spending a good chunk of 2024 on the rise. And now part of that is the escalation of tensions in the Middle East and concerns about supply, potential supply disruption. Certainly, you know, the attack on, you know, the original Hamas attack in Israel late last year, and the regional tensions related to, as you mentioned, the Red Sea and attacks from Houthi rebels in the Red Sea, for example. These are all playing a role from the supply side. But there's also other supply-demand dynamics that have been pushing in the direction, I think, of higher oil prices throughout the bulk of the year. The big one from the demand side is that growth has just come in stronger than expected. I think, once again, the global economic consensus of growth is likely to be slowing and heading towards recession in a lot of major economies, you know, has been delayed once more. The U.S. has been the most obvious example where growth expectations have really rebounded in a significant way. But they've also stabilized in a number of other economies, right? You've seen in Europe, for example, and in the U.K., survey data has not been as weak. Some of the PMI data, for example, have been a little bit stronger. And even in China, you had an above consensus GDP growth in the first quarter coming in at over 5%. So expectations around growth, I'd say, outside of the U.S. have stabilized at lower levels with maybe some green shoots of optimism coming in. Whereas in the U.S., which is obviously a huge demander and consumer of energy, of all global products and especially energy, growth expectations have blown out to the top side. The consumer has just shown almost no signs of retracement. Employment continues to be extremely strong. So there's a positive kicker coming from the demand side that the concern about big drops in oil demand that would normally come with a big slowdown in economic activity just have not been realized in a meaningful way, especially in the US, but also in some of the other large global economies. On the other side, from the supply front, if we sort of take the geopolitical tensions to the side for a moment, there's also the policy of OPEC and its role in trying to keep supply growth relatively low. Saudi Arabia, especially within OPEC, has taken on a very defensive and price defensive stance. They're actually still producing 9 million barrels per day of oil. That's about 3 million barrels a day below their estimated spare capacity. And Saudi Arabia is also undershooting its own OPEC commitments voluntarily by 1 million barrels per day in terms of overall oil production. And they have that policy in place at least through the second quarter of this year. Saudi oil policy has been geared in an extremely defensive stance, very price supportive, with their thinking being that the expectation is that demand will slow. That slowing of global demand will slow demand for oil. And as a result, they need to preempt that slowdown by being aggressive in terms of limiting the amount of supply that can come to the market. Now, I think it's right to say that those fears of potential slowdown have not been realized so far. But this is something that the Saudis, I think, can continue to point to as a potential source of future weakness that they may need to still lean against. And so Saudi Arabia especially has been leading the charge within OPEC to keep oil supplies very tight. And as a result, that has been boosting prices. So you take that oil supply strategy where Saudi Arabia especially has been underproducing relative to its own OPEC requirements and also versus its spare capacity. U.S. production is back at record highs, more or less in terms of oil production, but it stalled out more recently. Saudi Arabia is really the main swing producer of oil at this point. And if they continue to keep this aggressively defensive price supportive strategy, even though growth is improving, that creates a positive backdrop from a supply demand perspective for oil. So then I think the natural next question is, what is the outlook for oil from here? And what can cause Saudi Arabia to maybe change that stance? I think from the Saudi perspective, oil prices are still within broad ranges that we've seen for the last, call it, year and a half or so. If you're looking at Brent crude oil, front future, for example, roughly speaking, a $75 to $95 per barrel range is where we've been for almost 15 months now. And so we're certainly towards the top end of that range, but we're hardly at levels that would be, you know, even close to where we were during the extreme moments of the Russia-Ukraine war in 2022, for example. We are not at levels where I think Saudi Arabia and OPEC are receptive to Western and importer complaints about oil prices being too high. Certainly from a market perspective, you have really seen a pretty consistent and move higher in oil prices and other broad commodity prices as well. Generally speaking, it's been a pretty solid start to the year for a lot of commodity prices and risk assets in general, right? But these prices have moved higher, but I don't think we're at a point when Saudi Arabia is willing to make a big change simply because of those higher prices. If anything, I think the Saudis and OPEC likely see oil prices having remained within a fairly wide but still somewhat stable range. Now, I think where that changes is if oil prices break definitively out of this range. We are heading into the summer driving season here in the Northern Hemisphere, which tends to be a time when inventories draw down, demand moves higher naturally as more individuals are driving cars and flying and what have you. So I think there's a possibility that if you're approaching $100 a barrel or above as we get into the next big OPEC meeting on June 1st, that might be a moment when Saudi Arabia might consider whether it's still appropriate to keep these voluntary cuts of 1 million barrels per day above their expectations. That might be a moment when they consider whether or not that's still appropriate. That, I think, is the big supply factor to watch out for, independent of the geopolitical considerations, is there a price level at which OPEC is willing to make a major change in its very defensive price supportive strategy that it's had for really the last several years? I don't think we're approaching those levels at the moment. I think it would take further upside in order to do so. So those are the big events that we'll be watching specifically on the supply side. OPEC, its next meeting on June 1st, I think it's going to be pretty critical. And from the demand side, what is the, you know, can this relatively stronger period of growth we've seen, is that sustainable? Is that going to be keep supporting oil demand expectations for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, I think it's really key what you say, just that psychologically important $100 per barrel level. Brian, thank you so much for joining me. That's probably about all we have time for this week. But if you did like the podcast, please do click like and remember to subscribe so you get the latest episode first. Thanks again.